On Saturday night, the night that Kevin and Don were killed, Kevin left the house, headed to the Bright commuter parking lot to meet up with Don. I happened to be going into Little Rock that night, and so I was right behind him and came around the loop of the Bryant overpass to see Kevin pull up and park his car there and get out, get his brush out of the car and brush his hair, which he always did after riding somewhere with the T-tops off. And so that was actually my last time of ever seeing him, and actually a good memory for me seeing him do what I've seen him do many, many times before. But so I went on into Little Rock, not worrying about things, assuming that everything would go as planned and as talked about. But instead, the next morning, I received a phone call from Curtis Henry asking me if I knew where the boys were. And I was immediately fired up and mad because we'd already been through this the weekend before. And I'd been assured there were no more issues and problems and everything would be fine. But instead, he told me that the boys had come home as planned and by the time they were supposed to be home, but that he had allowed them to go out hunting that night to spotlight deer. And I can't even express how shocked I was. That was something that we would have never allowed Kevin to do, much less anybody else's child. And so I asked him if they took a gun, and he said, well, of course they did. And that immediately alarmed me. And I asked him if he had called the police yet. And he said no, that he wanted to check with his daughter, Gayla, before doing that. And so I sort of made busy work there waiting to hear back from Curtis, you know, having talked to Gayla to see if she knew where they were. And I was both mad, I was shocked, I guess the whole spectrum of emotions. So I sat around killing time, I suppose, trying to figure out what I needed to do, who I needed to call. Did I need to call Larry? Do I need to call the police? Do I need to get in the car and go look? What do I need to do? And so I did nothing, basically, just sitting there waiting. Finally heard back from Curtis, and I was hoping to be relieved to hear that, you know, the boys had spent the night with Gayla again, like they had the weekend before. And he told me that the minute I answered the phone, he said, come quick, Linda. They've been shot, tied to the railroad tracks, and run over by a train. And I can't even tell you the horror. I just, you know, I thought, this guy is crazy. And, you know, it was so beyond the realm of what I expected, I suppose. I couldn't even think. The first thing I thought of was, I don't even know where you live, Curtis. And so he tried giving me directions to his house, which I couldn't write down. I couldn't get hold of a pencil or anything else to write on. And so I told him to wait a minute and I'd call him back. And so I wrote his phone number down and called my next door neighbor, who I called in all of my emergencies when Larry wasn't home. And he knew the minute he heard my voice, something was wrong, and immediately ran the short distance from his house to my house through the woods. And he asked me what was wrong, and I couldn't even answer. That was just the craziest thing I could even think of. My mind just refused to process, you know, the words he had said. And I said, we have to go talk to this man. And I said, call him and get directions to his house. And he did, and got directions to the Henry house. And we got in my car and drove over there. Before we left the house, his wife, Gail, came running into the house, you know, wanting to know what was wrong immediately. And I couldn't say the words. I couldn't even say the words. And I said, we have to go straighten something out about Kevin. And I said, this man says, and well, they asked me where Kevin was. And I said, this man says he's been shot and tied to the railroad tracks and run over by a train. And Gail fell in the floor, literally crying. And I was still trying to figure it all out in my head, I suppose. And I told her, I said, Gail, get up. And I said, call my sister and have her come over here. I said, L.A. and I are going over to the Henry House to straighten this out about Kevin. And that's what I thought we were going to do, go over there and straighten things out. And, of course, that couldn't have been further from the truth. And we went and drove to the Henry home. L.A. was holding my hand so tightly the whole way, and he was crying. And I was not. I had not cried a tear at that point. But he was holding my hand so tightly. I just remember thinking, he's going to crush my hands. And we had a little trouble finding the house and the street, the address. And I remember looking down that street that they lived on, seeing Kevin's car sitting in a driveway. And I felt immense relief immediately. And I thought, oh, it's all straightened out. They're back and everything's okay. Because I had assumed that the boys were gone, you know, in Kevin's car. And so when we drove up, I was met in the yard by Saline County Deputy Chuck Talent. And I asked him, the first thing out of my mouth was, have they been shot and tied to the railroad tracks and run over by a train? And he said, Miss Ives, he said, can we just go in the house a minute and talk? And I immediately knew, you know, everything was not okay. And so we went in the house. First time I had met Curtis and Marvell Henry. And the first thing we were asked was for a description of their clothing. And I told them what shirt Kevin was wearing to the color and size. Description of it, same thing with his jeans and shoes and socks, the brand, the sizes and everything. And then when Curtis tried to tell him what Don had on, for some reason or other, I was immediately just totally irritated because he couldn't answer the question. He didn't have a clue what Don had on. And not that that's any big thing and not even surprising that a father or a man would not be as aware of those things as a mother is, but I just was so immediately ticked over that whole thing, you know, and it's so minuscule when I look back on it and think, you know, my reaction to that one little thing when everything was wrong with everything. And after giving Chuck Talent a description of the boys' clothing, he told us that he could not tell us for certain that the victims were Kevin and Don, but based on those descriptions of clothing that I had given him of Kevin's, that that matched the clothing of one of the victims. I asked him where Kevin was, and he told me that the boys were at the Little Rock Crime Lab, and that official identification and positive identification would have to come from the crime lab. So we went home. I went home to wait for a call from the crime lab, assuming that it would be coming very soon. When my friend and I returned to my house, there are already a lot of people there, friends, neighbors, family, whomever. A large crowd of people had already gathered at my house. And, of course, when I walked into the room, they were all looking for answers as to what was going on. And I just took one look at the crowd of faces looking expectantly at me for information, and I just couldn't even talk about it at that point. And I just walked straight in the door, went back to my bedroom, and locked it. Locked the door behind me, and sat down on the bed trying to figure out what to do. And I knew, of course, I had to call Larry, which was the worst possibly phone call I'd ever made. And I didn't know what to say. I really didn't know anything. Didn't even know if it was Kevin. I knew he would have lots of questions, and I had no answers. And so I just sat there on the bed and rocked myself and sort of bounced on the bed. I don't know, kind of crazy sounding, but that's what I did. I just sat there for the longest time trying to figure out what to do and what to say. And finally picked up the phone and called the railroad and told them I had to get through to Larry, that I had an emergency. And they immediately, what they call, patched me through to him. He was in Poplar Bluff, Missouri, where he had worked a job for the railroad in there that day. And they patched me through to him. And I just said, Larry, I need you to come home. And thinking that that was benign enough that maybe he wouldn't ask me anything. And of course, it immediately just alarmed him. And he said, "What's wrong?" And he thought it was my mother. He was elderly and stayed with us often. And I said, "No, it's not mother." And he said, "What is it?" He said, "Is it Alicia?" Which is our daughter, and she was in school in Fayetteville at the time, and we worried constantly about her driving back and forth to Fayetteville. So he assumed the worst, he thought, that came to mind, which was that Alicia had maybe had a wreck or something. And I finally got out the information that it was not Alicia. And of course, I didn't leave too many other people. And he said, "What's wrong with Kevin?" Not in that way, in a very emotional way, which, of course, made me very emotional. And I couldn't even get the words out of my mouth. He said, "Linda, what's wrong with Kevin?" He said, "Is Kevin okay?" And I just sat there shaking my head, I'm sure. And he said, "Has Kevin had a wreck?" Because at that time, that's the worst that you assumed as a parent of a teenage driver, the worst thing that came to his mind and my mind too. And I told him, "No, there had not been a car wreck." And of course, his mind was racing, trying to figure out, you know, what on earth could possibly, you know, create this kind of a conversation. And I just said, "Larry, all I know is they told me they thought he had been shot and tied to the railroad track and run over by a train." And I could hear commotion, sobbing in the background. And, you know, I knew exactly what he was feeling, which of course upset me tremendously. And I just kept trying to say, "We really don't know anything. We really don't know anything." And I said, "Just come home." And he told me, he said, "I'm on my way." And he said, "They're going to put me on a train, what they call a hot shot, which could get to here faster than he could by driving a vehicle." And he said, "I'll be home as soon as I can." And so I sat back and began the wait, the watch for Larry to get home. I kept telling myself over and over and over again that Larry would know what to do. You know, I didn't have a clue what I needed to do. I knew I needed to make phone calls, but I didn't want to. I had no information. And so I just sat there trying to figure out what to do. And I assumed that when Larry got home, he would know what to do. And all of our friends began knocking on the door, wanting me to come out. They were wanting to try to soothe me, I'm sure. And I didn't want to talk to or see anybody. And I just kept sitting on the bed, rocking. And thought I'll just sit right here until Larry gets here. And so they continued to knock and plead with me to come out, and I finally did. I got to thinking that I did owe him at least some sort of type of information, which, you know, I didn't know what, but I did go out and talk to them, and they all began in an effort to try to help me to start making some plans, tell me what I needed to do, which was the last thing I wanted to hear. And of course, the first thing they wanted me to do was to call Alicia. And I was bound and determined I was not going to tell Alicia over the phone, because I knew I knew what that would be. And I kept telling them to know that when Larry got here, he and I would drive to Fayetteville and get Alicia and bring her home, that I was not going to tell her anything over the phone. But they became quickly concerned because of how fast news was spreading, how many people were hearing, how many people were calling and asking questions about things. And it was kids that had siblings in Fayetteville, too. And they were afraid that Alicia was going to hear something before it came from us. And the beat was on to call Alicia. And I just stubbornly refused for a long time, probably at least a couple hours. Maybe I just couldn't even stand the idea of making that phone call. And I finally became clear to me even that, you know, it had to be done. And it really did need to be done soon. I did not want her hearing stuff. There were already, I don't know what to call them other than wild stories out there. At that point, they were simply wild stories to me. Of course, unfortunately, some of them were true. And so I finally decided I was going to call Alicia. And so I went back to my bedroom, shut the door and locked it, and sat down on the bed again, got the phone in my hand, and looked at it for a while, and finally dialed the phone. And my first thought was, I hope she's not by herself. And she was living with two college roommates in an apartment at the time. So when she picked up the phone and answered, I almost hung up. But I thought, well, that'd be crazy. And so I asked her, Alicia, who's there? Is Jimmy Lou there? Which was one of her roommates. And she said, no, Mom, she's not here. I said, is Lisa there? And she said, no, she's not here. Why do you want them? And, you know, she was surprised I was asking for them instead of her. And she said, what's going on? And I said, well, Alicia, is anybody else close by that you know? And she said, Mother, what's going on? Is something wrong with Nanny, my mother? And I said, no, it's not. It's not Nanny, Alicia. And she immediately started crying. And she said, it's Kevin, isn't it? She said, something's wrong with Kevin. And, of course, I literally froze. And I said, Alicia, I need you to come home. And she knew something was terribly wrong at that point, because, you know, I would have never asked her to leave school and come home in the middle of the week or even on the weekend. And of course, that was the weekend, but knowing she had class the next day. And my friends had bought a plane ticket for Alicia and had it waiting at the airport for her at Fayetteville. They have just a very small airport where small planes fly in and out only. And I told her, I said, Alicia, get somebody over there right now. I said, call anybody that you know close by. And I said, have them take you to the airport. And I said, there's going to be a ticket waiting for you there. Just go to the counter and tell them that there's a ticket in your name. And I said, they'll tell you what to do. And of course, she was just alarmed, flabbergasted, confused, crying. And she said, Mother, I'm not hanging up this phone until you tell me what's wrong. And knowing Alicia, I knew that was true. And so I finally just said, she said, who is it? She said, what's wrong? And I said, "It's Kevin." And she just started screaming and screaming and screaming. And I heard her throw the phone down. And in a few minutes, I sat there glued to the phone, listening, trying to figure out and asking her to pick up the phone. And could hear someone come in and could hear a little talking going on. And they picked up the phone and asked me who I was and what was going on and what was wrong with Alicia. And I told them to throw some clothes, some underwear in a bag, and to please just take her to the airport, which they, of course, agreed to do. And so that's how we got Alicia home, was by airplane through the help of friends and neighbors. So then the watch became wait for Larry, wait for Alicia. And it was a very typically morbid, I suppose, sort of, don't know what else to call it, watch party. People were bringing in food. People were bringing in drinks. People were still coming out of the woodwork. People I didn't even know. Big crowd at the house. A lot of commotion. My whole mind was such chaos, and you know, the whole atmosphere was extremely difficult. I don't know what word to put to it. You know, I just wanted Alicia and I wanted Larry. And so we waited. And finally, it was time for Larry to arrive by train. His brothers went and picked him up at the yards in North Little Rock where the trains come in. And I sat and paced the garage, or stood and paced the garage, I guess, and walked in circles and I don't know how many miles waiting for him to drive in the driveway. And, you know, expecting relief and help and somebody who knew what to do. And when they got out of the car, his brothers all got out of the car, and friends gathered around him and literally carried him into the house. And I remember thinking, what am I going to do now? You know, and I thought, Larry doesn't know any more than I do what to do. You know, and he was as big of an emotional wreck as I was. And I just remember feeling such desperation at the idea that nobody knew what to do. And in fact, probably was nothing, you know, anybody could do. And so they carried Larry back to the bedroom, where I again locked the door behind us. And we sat on the bed and cried. And not much conversation. You know, he asked me again, you know, what I knew, which was nothing. You know, not even, you know, known that they were absolutely the victims. But that the crime lab was supposed to call. And so the watch then became mine and Larry's mostly, although we still had many friends and family there that waited through the night with us. But we sat up all night waiting for that phone call that never came. I guess I just assumed at some point that the call would come immediately, but it didn't until the next day. It never did come from the crime lab with a positive ID. The next phone call I received was from Chuck Talent, Saline County Sheriff's Office again. And he said, "Miss Ives, where do you want the body taken?" And I was just totally horrified. Angry. I don't even know what all I was. I was mad because he called him the body, number one. And I immediately told him that body has a name. His name is Kevin. And, of course, I didn't know where to take him. And so I told him, I said, "I'll have to get back with you." And so then, of course, Larry and I had to make a lot of very difficult decisions. After that, funeral homes and services and things like that, which, you know, we still had no idea. We didn't know when they would release the body. They were unable to answer that question. And so again, we waited for somebody to know something somewhere and to let us know something. And it just seemed like I was constantly sitting there waiting for something to happen. Didn't know what, didn't know when, or anything like that. But eventually did get that phone call from Saline County Sheriff's Office. So the following day on the Monday, after the boys had been killed, and we, even at that point in time, we were already hearing what I called for a long time wild stories. And at that point in time, that's all they were. And that's all they were for a very long time, unfortunately. And still today, 32 years later, many of them are still wild stories that I don't know whether are true or not. It's so hard to tell. But we were already hearing rumors that the boys had been shot. And I, of course, my first question was, because Curtis had told me that the minute he called me, that they'd been shot and tied to the railroad tracks and run over by a train, you know, my question was, had they been? And where did he hear that? And he didn't know. Saline County said no, there was absolutely no indication of that. But we were still getting all of this information from every direction about different things, even drugs that early. But we knew that we had to, the first thing that we had to do was to make funeral arrangements, which Larry and I did that following day on Monday. And I remember going into the funeral home, and I can't even describe what it's like to try to figure out and pick out a coffin for your child. And, you know, I remember being led into a room that had, I don't know how many, it seemed like dozens of coffins, every color, every size, different colored interiors, different colored metals and woods and things. And I was just dumbfounded. And I just kind of stood there and looked around the room for the longest time. And finally, the funeral director said, Miss Ives, is there one that you like better than the others? And, you know, my head just snapped. I almost could hear it crack. And I said, I don't like any of them. And, of course, he didn't know what to say and what to do with me. And so Larry said, come on, Linda, let's just take a look. So we walked around that room and we looked and talked about the colors of the interiors of the caskets. And I remember Larry saying, well, this one is blue. And he said, it's almost the same color as the interior of Kevin's car. And I remember being so shocked at, you know, I thought, what the hell does that have to do with anything? You know, but then, of course, it seemed to make a little bit of sense to me. And I thought, well, yeah, that would be okay. You know, Kevin, you know, would probably like that. And it was just like not even being in reality. It seemed so unreal. And so we finally chose one, a very pretty wooden casket with a blue velour interior, or velvet, I'm not sure what it was. And that's what we chose. And then we began to make all of the other arrangements for the service and everything, which was held the following Wednesday, I believe, a couple of days after the deaths, or after the funeral arrangements were made. And one of Kevin's friends came to us and asked us if we would play Kevin's favorite song at the funeral. And it made me almost guilty to think, I wasn't even really sure at that point what Kevin's favorite song was. He had a bazillion of them. And he said, no, this one he had playing on his car radio every time you saw him. It would be, you know, coming out the windows and, you know, making your body reverberate and everything. And it was called Stairway to Heaven. And I thought, well, that sounds appropriate. Sure, we'll play it. And so, you know, we went about the other decisions that had to be made. And so when the service was held, it was a very gut-wrenching and solemn and service to me, of course, which I I was so distracted I could barely even pay attention to what was being said or done or anything else. But I remember when that song coming on that the only thing that you could hear were some sobs and some crying and everything. But when that song came on, all of those kids, the hundreds of them that were there, all began sobbing and crying and, you know, immediately just kind of identified with everything that was going on and were totally absorbed by the song, I suppose. And I thought they had the wrong song on. I looked at Larry and he looked at me, and I mean, I didn't know what to expect from it. It was, of course, a rock song by Lynyrd Skynyrd. And I just thought, oh my gosh, they've got the wrong song on. And so I was rather relieved when I thought everybody's going to think it's shameful to play rock music at his funeral. And I thought, well, this ought to make for good talk in the town. So, but anyway, I thought, what are people going to say about this? That was my first thought. And but when I realized, you know, the reaction that the kids had to it, I didn't care what anybody else's reaction was. And, you know, we were perfectly okay with it and realized everything was as it should have been. After the funeral, of course, we had to go to the cemetery. And I remember the first time I walked up and saw the hole in the ground at that point and a pile of dirt sitting beside it. And it dawned on me, I guess, for the first time, you know, that they were actually going to put him in the ground, which, of course, I knew, but hadn't really spent a lot of time thinking about till I saw that big old pile of dirt they were going to put on him. And I found it really, really hard to leave the cemetery. I thought, I can't leave him here. It felt like I was abandoning him. I thought, I can't leave him here. And so I stood there and hung around and visited with people and that kind of thing. But finally, the funeral director came up to me and he said, Linda, you're going to have to leave. He said, it's etiquette at a graveside that people don't leave before the mother or the main person grieving leaves. He said, they're not going to leave until you do. And I remember thinking, I just can't. I can't leave here. But, of course, finally did. Came back a little while later to see the grave after they had filled it in and put the flowers on it and everything. Was kind of surprised to see a pretty big gathering of kids and people sitting around just talking and crying and different things. And I thought, well, I'm not the only one that couldn't leave. But it kind of became a, I don't know, tradition is the right word or not, but it became a common occurrence to go out there, and did go out there a lot. In fact, spent probably 80% of my time out there at the cemetery after that for a long time. But, you know, for there to be people out there and kids, and, you know, the kids would take things and put it on Kevin's grave, like little toy cars, especially Camaros. Also would take a Mountain Dew and leave it on his grave, because you rarely saw Kevin without a Mountain Dew in his hand. And, you know, it was a comfort to me that they still thought about him and cared enough to go out there, too. You know, I certainly, I don't know how much of a comfort it was, but for me to be out there, but I just had to be there. I just, you know, I found it hard to leave there every time I went. I just kept feeling like I was leaving him. And so that became kind of a common occurrence. Kids also got locked in the cemetery several times, I think. They would lock and close the gates at dark, and they would get locked in and have to call to be let out. And, you know, it gave me a sense of satisfaction knowing, you know, that they still thought about Kevin. And they also would come to the house and sit on his bed, go through his things and talk about him and cry, which was gut-wrenching for me. But, you know, there was no way on this green earth you know, I was ever going to tell one of them they couldn't come or shouldn't come. And so that continued to go on for some time.